Of note, subsequent to my interview with Dr. Kopetz, TAS 102 was approved by the FDA for the treatment of patients with metastatic colorectal cancer who have previously received fluoropyrimidine oxaliplatin and irinotecan-based chemotherapy, an anti-VEGF agent, and an anti-EGFR monoclonal antibody if RAS wild type. I next met with Dr. David Ryan, and to begin, he presented a patient from his practice with pancreatic cancer.
So I take care of a 65-year-old man who presented with jaundice. He had a stent placed, and the CT scan and the EUS both showed a 3-centimeter mass in the head of the pancreas. Now, the CT showed that there was some involvement of the SMV. I called it kissing the SMV. But it was less than, I'd say, it was definitely less than a half of the circumference, and I would say it was about a quarter of the circumference of the SMV. And I'm not sure in the old days that our surgeons would have called this borderline resectable. They may have just taken this patient straight to the operating room. And when I'm talking about the old days, I'm talking, say, greater than 3 or 4 years ago. But now I've noticed our surgeons are looking for any excuse to call something borderline or any excuse to give preoperative therapy. And the surgeon in this case insisted on preoperative chemotherapy with FOLFIRINOX. And the patient had a great response. It's still, what was interesting is that the tumor shrunk down. There still seemed to be some component that was going out towards the SMV. At our institution, we still believe in chemoradiation for these folks. So we gave the patient 6 weeks of continuous infusion 5-FU with radiation. And then he went to the OR about a month after that. 4 to 6 weeks is our window for taking people to the operating room. And he only had these residual glands of adenocarcinoma. In fact, everything that was beyond the pancreas was just fibrotic tissue. There was no cancer beyond the pancreas. And he's doing well now 2 years later. Still off of all therapy, still nothing's come back. And is he cured? I hope so. I think so, but I'm not sure. And we're going to continue to follow.
So can you talk a little bit about this man presented with the situation you describe, a more typical presentation? There's a patient with metastatic disease. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about how you determine, I guess, two of the more common regimens that are used in this situation nowadays are FOLFIRINOX, which is what he got, and gemcitabine nab-paclitaxel. Can you talk about how you make the decision about first-line therapy?
As you know, we don't have any head-to-head data yet to tell us whether FOLFIRINOX is better than gemcitabine and nab-paclitaxel. And both of the regimens have been shown to improve survival compared with gemcitabine alone. FOLFIRINOX has been out a little bit longer. It was adopted a little bit earlier in the Boston area than gemcitabine, nab-paclitaxel. I would say that my own feeling is that on average, they probably work about the same. The FOLFIRINOX, I would say, is definitely more toxic than gemcitabine and nab-paclitaxel. On the other hand, if I had to guess, I would say that the likelihood of hitting a home run, which I would define as being alive 2 years down the road, I would think FOLFIRINOX might have a slightly better advantage, but that's my bias. You know, that's Yankees versus Red Sox kind of talk. And so typically what I will do is I'll sit down with the patient and describe the two regimens. I'll describe what's in FOLFIRINOX. I'll describe what's in gemcitabine and nab-paclitaxel. I'll describe the logistics. And I think the logistics, more than anything, swayed patients who want to do the gemcitabine and nab-paclitaxel. They're not interested in the pump. They're not interested in coming back for Neulasta. They're not interested in the extra hydration that's sometimes involved with FOLFIRINOX. We are very aggressive with hydration with FOLFIRINOX. We're very aggressive with antiemetics with FOLFIRINOX. And so that kind of extra toxicity, they're not interested in, and the extra logistics, they're not interested in, and they'll go with gemcitabine, nab-paclitaxel. On the other hand, the patient who says to me, I've looked at the data, we tend to have a very educated population in Boston. It's not unusual for them to come in knowing both studies, like the back of their hand, and saying to me, geez, Dave, the FOLFIRINOX had an 11-month median overall survival. I'd like to go for that one. And we go for it. And we've actually become very good at managing the toxicity. I'd say in the beginning, we struggled like everybody else did to try and figure out how to manage that toxicity. But I'd say nowadays, we're much better at it.
Anything new and exciting in terms of systemic therapy of pancreatic cancer?
Well, so there's the ruxolitinib data that looked promising. We're waiting for the follow-up clinical trials to that. Of course, it seemed to have an effect in patients around the whole issue of cachexia that they experience. Obviously, the marker they used was CRP, which is a poor man's guide for how cachectic and how much kind of systemic inflammatory syndrome that you have associated with your cancer, and in this case, particular pancreatic cancer. So that's interesting. I think the problem with pancreatic cancer, though, right now in terms of targeted therapy is we haven't figured out the KRAS story yet. And obviously, 90%+ of these patients are KRAS mutated, or KRAS mutant, I should say. And until we have a good therapy to go after KRAS on the targeted side, then I think we're not going to make any huge progress there. It'll be interesting to see how the immuno-oncology programs work this out. So far, I haven't heard anything in terms of pancreatic cancer responding wonderfully well to immunotherapy, but there are some really interesting ideas out there about how to get around that, how to present antigens, how to use checkpoint inhibitors. And so I'd say that's where I'm interested in mostly right now, that and KRAS-directed therapy.
Yeah, the number of cancers we're not talking about checkpoint inhibitors nowadays is getting pretty small. Colorectal cancer was one topic that we never got into, but as you said, then there was ASCO.
But even colorectal cancer, I mean, for the 90-95% of patients who are microsatellite stable, the PD-1 therapies haven't done anything really. So it varies. For GI cancers in general, it'll be interesting to see how it plays out. I would imagine the data so far, the early data coming out would suggest the MSI-high patients, the gastric cancer patients, there's a subset of gastric cancer patients that do incredibly well. There appears to be a subset of liver cancer, HCC patients, that do extremely well. But microsatellite stable patients, pancreatic cancer patients, we're not hearing any great home runs so far coming out of the clinical trials.
Right. And you mentioned gastric cancer, and that's the other thing I wanted to talk to you about today. Maybe you can talk about your 66-year-old man.
I took care of a 66-year-old man with metastatic gastric adenocarcinoma recently. We worked him up for HER2 amplification, MET amplification. We did all sorts of molecular genotyping on him. Unfortunately, he had nothing that was actionable, and so we placed him on FOLFOX. He did well on FOLFOX initially. Like gastric adenocarcinoma, often you can see great responses in the beginning. The problem with gastric adenocarcinoma is those great responses are typically short-lived. In his case, roughly 6 to 8 months after beginning FOLFOX, as I recall, he had dramatic progression of his disease, and which was very disappointing because he had had such a dramatic reduction. He had had some liver metastases and lung metastases. Everything got better on the FOLFOX and got better dramatically. He felt fantastic, was golfing all the time, absolutely loved the FOLFOX. He didn't have much in the way of neuropathy. He felt great, and he thought that he was going to be the one who lived forever on FOLFOX and get 5 years out of it. But unfortunately, it came roaring back around month 7 or so, as I said. And so we placed him on paclitaxel and ramucirumab at that point. And he did really well again. He had a really nice response. I would say it wasn't quite as good as the initial response on FOLFOX. I would say that his liver and lung metastases, as I recall, they didn't shrink by half, but you know, they shrunk by a good 25-30%, and he felt great. The neuropathy started to kick in a little bit, but other than that, he tolerated therapy extremely well.
So I'm curious about your experience with ramucirumab. First of all, do you ever use it without chemotherapy?
Occasionally, I would say in the beginning when it first came out, I used it once or twice as a single agent, and in part because those patients had already progressed on FOLFOX and paclitaxel. But ever since now that I've been taking care of patients who haven't had second-line chemotherapy, if they're not going on a clinical trial and I'm going to use second-line chemotherapy, I'm going to include ramucirumab.
You mentioned that this patient was starting to have some neuropathy. Are there situations where you'd stop the paclitaxel and keep the ramucirumab going, for example, when a patient with neuropathy?
Sure. So neuropathy is one. Neuropathy is a clear-cut example of that. The other example that I've run into recently is myelosuppression. You get a little bit more myelosuppression with ramucirumab than you do with bevacizumab. And so in this particular patient, they had a little bit of neuropathy, and I talked to them. This is another patient very similar to this man that we discussed. And she said to me, geez, Dave, you know, if I get a choice here, and I said, you sure do. You get the choice. You're the coach. I'm just the quarterback. I'm throwing the ball. You're calling the plays. And she said, I'd rather you drop the paclitaxel and continue on with the ramucirumab. And I said, then you got it. And we continued on with the ramucirumab. And she did well, actually, for another, I'd say, 4 months or so on ramucirumab as a single agent, as I recall. And then we went on to clinical trials afterwards. But I think that continuing on RAM as a single agent is perfectly fine.
I'm curious in terms of new agents and gastric cancer, and one type of agent I was curious about are the inhibitors of stem cell inhibitors. There's a BBI-503, BBI-608, there are a bunch of other compounds. Can you talk about what those agents do and whether you think it's heading anywhere?
Well, it's interesting. The stemness of cancer seems to be popular right now. It's based mostly on the theory that there's a subset of cells that are perhaps much more like stem cells than they are like the epithelial cancers that we see dividing. A smaller population that if you don't take care of and don't develop drugs against, that you're never going to really get ahead of these cancers. And we can find cells like this on different biopsies with specific molecular genotyping and also some expression on with cell surface markers as well. And things like inhibiting STAT3 and inhibiting WNT. And there's a lot of hand-waving, though, from my viewpoint, that goes on with stemness. And I think that's because the science isn't fully baked yet. Having said that, though, there really is a feeling that's coming out of some of the circulating tumor cell literature, for instance, that there's this population of cells that is more mesenchymal or stem-like in nature, and that if we're really going to get ahead of these cancers and hit home runs, not just allow people to live for 2 months longer than they otherwise were meant to live in terms of cytotoxic chemotherapy, that we have to go after these stem cell markers or markers of stemness. And so I'm cautiously optimistic that we'll get there. I'm not sure we're going to get there with the first generation because I don't think the science, I think in some ways the science hasn't caught up to some of the drugs, and we're not quite sure what the effect is with these drugs on the stemness, so to speak, or are they just working on their specific pathway that they're working on, and is that pathway important in that particular cancer? So that's a kind of hand-waving, I guess, but I tend to be an optimistic guy, so I remain cautiously optimistic.
Any other new agents or new strategies coming out in gastric cancer? And I'm curious also about where things are today with HER2 positive. We were talking about HER2 amplified colon cancer in terms of HER2 positive gastric cancer.
So I think gastric cancer, the big story in gastric cancer that's going to come out is the effectiveness of the PD-1 antibodies. I think that the initial response seen in Japan was just dramatic. Figuring out which subset of gastric cancer patients those are they the hypermutated folks? You know, the current theory on who's responding to the PD-1 therapies are those patients that have a log order more mutations than the average cancer and have some kind of neoantigen. They, of course, have to be using the PD-1 checkpoint pathway. And then if they have a neoantigen, they're using the PD-1 checkpoint pathway, and you use a PD-1 antibody, you're going to get this dramatic response. And so those clinical trials have started. In fact, my understanding is that they've accrued incredibly rapidly, and we should be getting our answers, I would think, within the next year as to whether those are going to be effective or not. So that should be really fun to watch and incredibly excited for gastric cancer in the short term around that particular issue. As regards to HER2, there's the next generation of HER2 therapies. I think that it'll be interesting to see what T-DM1 does eventually in this disease. It'll be interesting to see what the HER2 plus HER3 strategy does. I have to say, I think we are basically in gastric cancer following the lead of breast cancer when it comes to HER2. So you're seeing all the same studies that are being done in breast cancer just 18 months later or so, 18, 24 months later, getting done in gastric cancer along HER2. And I think that so far, my sense is that things are going to be, again playing out in the same way as they're playing out in breast cancer.
So let's talk about advanced colorectal cancer, beginning with the latest drug that became available, TAS-102.
So TAS-102 is in the fluoropyrimidine pathway, and it has an activity level that's similar to regorafenib. In a randomized controlled study, it improves survival on the order of 1 to 2 months. You don't get a ton of great responses with TAS-102, but it's well tolerated. It's easy to administer, and I see the uptake of it to be fairly widespread. People are going to be very comfortable with this, both on the doctor side and the patient side. The side effect profile is fairly standard, with some GI side effects, some mild myelosuppression and the like. And when patients hear that it's going to be like 5-FU, they'll know exactly what they're getting into. And I think you're going to see the uptick to be quite high, actually.
Of course, the other agent that's relevant in the post-chemo biologic third line and beyond space is regorafenib. And there's a lot of debate about the optimal dosing. How do you approach this?
Well, so the drug comes in 40 milligram tablets, and the standard drug dosing is 160 milligrams. I have to say that, like every oncologist, I'm snake bit by personal experience with toxicity, in the sense that the first couple of patients that I used 160 milligrams, I quickly had to dose reduce. They had bad hand-foot syndrome and mouth sores, and one patient had bad diarrhea. It was really miserable with 160 milligrams. So I'm actually careful about the dose, probably more so maybe than I should be, or more so than the data suggests. But I typically will start most patients on 120 and then go up. If they tolerate the first month okay, then consider going up to 160. I would say, like any tyrosine kinase inhibitor, any promiscuous tyrosine kinase inhibitor like regorafenib is, the side effects you'll be very familiar with, and they happen to be mouth sores, diarrhea, hand-foot syndrome, rash, and a general sense of fatigue. That's what the data shows, and that's what I've experienced in my patients.
Have you observed patients to have clinically meaningful benefit from regorafenib?
It's hard to say. I think so, but it's hard to say. And the reason it's hard to say is that I would say that the patients who go on it in general have been patients who have had more indolent disease than the average person with metastatic colon cancer. Part of the problem that regorafenib has from a practical standpoint, it reminds me a lot of erlotinib in pancreatic cancer. And the uptick of erlotinib in pancreatic cancer hasn't been all that great, in part because of the side effect profile and in part because it's hard to convince doctors that their patients are getting meaningful benefit. Now, regorafenib actually has a better clinical profile in terms of overall survival than erlotinib in pancreatic cancer. But it too suffers from the issue of side effects in a patient population that can ill afford those types of side effects.
I was curious about your work with HIPEC, and I asked you to bring in a related case. And I see here you have this very challenging situation of a 30-year-old man.
He had peritoneal-only disease, so his liver and lungs and every place else was fairly clear. But he presented with widespread disease, carcinomatosis in the vernacular, and he had a great response to therapy. We started him on standard FOLFOX bevacizumab, and he started looking around on the internet. And he said, "Dave, how come we're not doing HIPEC? How come we're not going after this with cytoreduction and HIPEC?" And I said, "Well, we can. It's certainly possible." And so he went on a series of second opinions with several different surgeons, wound up with our surgeon at Mass General who does it. And he was taken to the operating room for cytoreductive surgery and HIPEC. At the time of the operation, the surgeon couldn't remove all the cancer. Got him down to a fairly low amount of cancer, but left some nodules, mostly up around the diaphragm. And then he was given HIPEC. And then we watched and waited after that. He recovered pretty well. He was happy. He was young and otherwise healthy, so he tolerated the procedure quite well. And then after about 6 months or so of following him with serial CT scans, it became evident that the peritoneal carcinomatosis was coming back. And it can be sometimes really hard to tell on routine CT scans after they've had cytoreduction and HIPEC. We've noticed that the patterns of recurrence aren't particularly classic. And he developed some disease up along the diaphragm where he was, but he also had some disease that was invading along the stomach wall, which really wasn't evident initially, But upon an upper endoscopy, this all occurred 6 to 8 months after his cytoreductive surgery, it was clear that the cancer was back and coming along the linings of different structures in the abdomen. And so we restarted him back on systemic chemotherapy at that point.
And what's his current situation?
He is doing systemic chemotherapy now, on and off with chemotherapy holidays. He's transitioned to FOLFIRI, bevacizumab, because of neuropathy on the oxaliplatin, and is somewhat resigned now to the fact that the cancer can't be cured. He was hoping, though, with the cytoreduction and the HIPEC, that he was curable. And so there's this whole discussion that takes place now with patients, given the popularity of HIPEC. There's a whole discussion that takes place, is can you actually cure somebody?
So you say given the popularity of HIPEC, but I didn't know it was popular, but maybe it's popular more at your place. But I was really curious. That's why I asked you to present one of these patients. I want to learn more about that. But before we get into that, can you talk a little bit more about the patient? He seems like he's a pretty proactive person. What was his background, his family situation, his work?
He was a young man who was unmarried and was an athlete throughout college and into young adulthood. Basically works not in the medical field, but was just about getting started off in life, really. Had a serious girlfriend, was considering getting married, and all of this kind of came out of the blue for him. Whenever you're talking to young people who have disease that is metastatic GI cancer, they look at you with disbelief that we can't cure this. And so I think what's interesting about the peritoneal carcinomatosis or the isolated peritoneal carcinomatosis debate is, can it be cured with HIPEC and with cytoreductive surgery? And when these folks visit centers that specialize in this type of procedure, often the surgeons will tell them that, yes, I can cure you, and we ought to go ahead and do this. And there's this kind of disbelief that takes place between the referring medical oncologist and the surgeon at the center of excellence that's doing this. And I think the community oncologists, because I tend to see a lot of second opinions with this type of diagnosis who've been around and to different centers of excellence that do this, and the community oncologists that take care of these patients are very confused about how do we manage them. And this particular person who I was taking care of was a great guy, and he was equally confused. He didn't know what to make of it. And he would come in with his parents, and his parents, who were not that much older than I am, would say, hey, you know, why aren't we doing this? Dr. So-and-so said there's a potential that he can be cured. Let's go after it.
So I see that you did an education session on peritoneal carcinomatosis of colorectal origin at the last ASCO meeting. What do we know about the sort of epidemiology of this? How often do you see cases like this where the disease is mainly peritoneal? How often do you see peritoneal involvement with other sites but being the dominant site?
So peritoneal involvement is actually one of the more common sites of metastatic spread for colon cancer. It happens somewhere around 20-25% of the time. But isolated peritoneal carcinomatosis is actually very rare, probably only happens somewhere around 2-5% of the time. And what I mean by isolated, I mean that there's no liver metastases, there's no nodal metastases, there's no lung metastases. We're just seeing carcinomatosis, essentially. And there's a huge variation in what constitutes isolated peritoneal carcinomatosis. You can have somebody with just an isolated nodule or two, or you can have widespread, as the radiologists will call it, they'll call it caking of the omentum, where it looks like a Duncan Hines white cake on the omentum. And that's part of the problem with this type of presentation is we don't have a good way of staging it. In fact, the only people who can stage it well are the surgeons. And of course, half the time I think when I'm talking to patients about peritoneal carcinomatosis, I'm talking about the disconnect between what the surgeon sees and what we see on the CT scan. The CT scan, of course, is a two-dimensional view, and I always use the example of the table in the room, and if I had thrown salt on the table, we could all tell that somebody had spilled salt on the table. But if we had CAT scanned that table, we would miss those individual nodules of salt. And similarly, for a surgeon, when they open up the abdomen, they can see these little nodules all over the place that, as a medical oncologist, once we see one or two of them, we expect that to be the case, that the surgeon's going to see it in the operating room. But on the CAT scan, we may not see that at all. We may just see a little thickening here and there, some ascites, and that's about it.
We've been doing quite a few education programs on ovarian cancer. You know, just listen to the story. I'm flashing on all the conversations I've had with those people about huge controversy about intraperitoneal therapy, debulking, optimal debulking, etc. Can you talk about what we know right now about HIPEC and other local management approaches to peritoneal carcinomatosis?
So HIPEC started about 30 years ago now. Early laboratory studies suggested that heating chemotherapy made it more toxic to cancer cells. Subsequent laboratory studies with more modern techniques haven't really borne that out, but it continues nevertheless. And during this procedure, the surgeons will do a thorough debulking of the cancer in the peritoneal cavity and then infuse HIPEC. Classically, they use either mitomycin or cisplatin. Nowadays, though, they're using more and more oxaliplatin. There was a randomized study that was done in Europe about 15 years ago now that suggested a survival benefit compared to 5-FU leucovorin alone. In fact, it did more than suggest a survival benefit. It was a statistically significant survival benefit. But it was a tragically flawed study in many ways because they had included patients with appendiceal cancer, which we know can behave very differently than colon cancer. And it turns out the long-term follow-up on that particular study showed that there was no difference in long-term survivors, meaning people who were going to live 5 to 10 years, people who were going to be cured. But the surgeons put together multiple surgical series. Some of them were phase two studies, but usually mostly surgical series. And what they showed consistently is that if you can remove all the tumor at cytoreduction, meaning render somebody R0, that there's about a 30% 5-year disease-free survival, not just overall survival. 30% of patients after 5 years will have no cancer, which is remarkable. But when we think about it, those of us in the medical oncology community had always dismissed, I was taught as a fellow in the mid-90s that, geez, you couldn't cure somebody with peritoneal disease and you shouldn't take them to the OR because it was giving false hope. But I think that's wrong. I think that much like liver and lung metastases, where there's this 30% or so cure rate, if you can take somebody with colon cancer and isolated liver or lung metastases to the operating room and render them free of disease, give them an R0 resection, about 30% of those folks might be cured, actually. And it stands to reason, and the studies would suggest that these patients who get a complete cytoreduction where they're rendered free of disease, their 5-year disease-free survival is about 30%. Now, the controversy, though, is that the places that always pushed this surgical cytoreduction always included HIPEC. And so the real controversy is, do you need to add the HIPEC or will the surgery alone do the job? And thankfully, the Europeans actually have gone ahead and they're going to answer this. We in the United States couldn't answer this. There was just too much disagreement about should you put these people on clinical trials. People felt so strongly one way or the other. But in Europe, they did the Prodige group, which is the French group, did a randomized controlled study, which finished accrual over this last year, where people with metastatic colon cancer who had isolated peritoneal disease were randomly assigned after cytoreductive therapy to either get HIPEC or not. So it really was a HIPEC question. And then everybody could get standard systemic chemotherapy. And we are actually going to find out from that study whether there's really a survival advantage to HIPEC. But I think that there's been an evolution in thought on these patients with isolated peritoneal disease. If you can get it all out and render somebody free of disease, truly with an R0 resection, I don't see why not.
Yeah, this concept of the R0 resection, again, you hear with ovarian cancer. And there, if they think, and they typically will do laparoscopy, I don't know how often that's done in colon cancer, but if they think they can't get an R0 resection, they'll use neoadjuvant chemotherapy. What about that strategy in colon cancer?
Well, everybody I know, including the folks at our place, everybody I know who does this now uses neoadjuvant therapy. So as soon as somebody's diagnosed, if somebody goes and gets a second opinion and says, oh, gee, I want to get HIPEC, what will happen is the expert at the Center of Excellence that does this will say to the patient, geez, you should go back home and get FOLFOX bevacizumab or FOLFIRI bevacizumab. Let's see how you do. Get scans every 2 months. And after 4 to 6 months, if you're having a great response to therapy, well, why then I'll go in and see what I can do at that point. And so practically speaking, I haven't seen anybody with this diagnosis, peritoneal carcinomatosis from a colorectal cancer, who hasn't had preoperative chemotherapy.
Interesting. What about, of course, the issue of toxicity? What do these people go through? What do this man, you said he tolerated it well, but what kinds of problems do you see?
So the surgical mortality is anywhere from 1% to 4% in the literature. It's even higher in lower volume centers. So it can be a very serious operation and is not correct for somebody who has multiple comorbidities to undergo. But it takes about 6 or 8 weeks to really recover from one of these operations on average. Patients take 2 or 3 weeks of healing up where they could even potentially be on TPN for a short period of time if they're not doing well postoperatively, depending upon how much bowel the surgeon had to take out, how long was the operation, et cetera. Classically, like any big operation, though, if your center's used to doing, for instance, a lot of Whipple operations, the recovery is somewhat similar. You have some people who seem to fly through the surgery without much in the way of problems, and this was the case here. But then I've had people who've really had a hard time. They had too much bowel resected. They've been on TPN for a long time. They have chronic diarrhea. Also, it's anecdotal, but I can say that the recurrences, if they don't get an R0 resection, if they go through this procedure and tumor comes roaring back, let's say, sometimes it can grow up along the incision. Sometimes it can grow along the bowel in a way that you rarely see in patients who haven't had this type of procedure. Meaning, for example, I had a patient one time who had this procedure who CT scans looked fine. He just had some strange thickening in the sigmoid colon. It looked almost the way diverticulitis or diverticular disease would look. It really didn't look like much at all, but it was new. And so we did a colonoscopy, and he had no other evidence of disease. This was about 6 months or so after one of these cytoreductive surgery and HIPEC procedures. And he had disease all up and down the colon, ulcerative disease that was growing from the outside of the colon into the inside throughout the entire colon. I think that was probably one of the first times I had ever seen that complication. And subsequently, now that we've been doing this and now that I have seen a number of people on second opinion, I've seen this a number of times, this complication where tumor grows along tissue planes. So that's the kinds of complications that you can see in people who undergo this.
No, they just get the chemotherapy once or they get it repeatedly?
Well, they get the HIPEC once, but they go on and get chemotherapy. If they have recurrent disease, you go on and give chemotherapy like you would for any other patient with metastatic colon cancer. Classically, you don't repeat the HIPEC. The patients who do get that occasionally are that your patients with really slow-growing appendiceal neoplasms, mucinous appendiceal neoplasms, the old pseudomyxoma peritonei, who can putt along for 5, 10, 15 years and undergo serial debulking.
So when the HIPEC is done, how long does it take? How long is the chemotherapy actually infused?
It differs from center to center, but usually you're talking 30 minutes to an hour, usually, and the surgeon just stands by there while the chemotherapy is in the abdomen. They'll even shake the abdomen around to get better penetration into all pockets of the peritoneum.
So you mentioned appendiceal cancer, and I'm curious whether there's any information available or if you have any hypotheses about, you know, kind of what's going on biologically, both with appendiceal cancer, but also with these unusual colon cancer variants that they grow like this.
It's a great question, Neil. And so far, the mutational analyses on these types of cancers haven't really led to any home run hypotheses on which types of cancers grow with this mucinous variant that fills the belly up with mucin or jelly. And I think we're going to get there. The full, I think, genome hasn't been explored. We haven't looked at all of the epigenetics that can go along with this. So nobody really has a good handle on why these cancers behave the way they behave and are different than a standard adenocarcinoma of the colon.